today is February 24th, 1994, and we're going to continue our conversation. And I do have just a few cleanup questions from the last session to ask you. Was there a reason why the town in which you were born was called Griderville?
Well, other than my father and his three brothers came there from Adair County and bought farmland, farms, and opened a little grocery store, and it was just the four Grider boys, and so they named it Griderville. And in fact, the little Grider grocery is still sitting there that a cousin is keeping open. It's not to make any money because it's just a very small little country grocery that, you know, maybe some of the people come in and get bologna sandwiches or a can of Vianney sausages or something and a cold drink. But it's still there, still in operation, and I have a cousin runs that. And then I have other cousins that still farm there. And that's probably after those four boys, that Grider boys that moved there.
Also, you mentioned in connection with, right before you joined the Marshal Service, knowing Louis Nunn and Thruson Morton's assistant, and I just, if that was correct.
Well, Louis, yes, Louis
how,
was.
How did that happen?
Well, Louis was is from Barron County. He's from Park, Kentucky. And he was elected county judge of Barron County. I think the first Republican that ever had been elected to county judge there. And, of course, that was the old county judge system, which they handled court and so forth, compared to today's county judge executive or whatever their titles are.
So you knew him just by virtue of it being a small town?
Small town, and me being on the police department, him a county judge, and of course we, and then his brother, Lee Nunn, which then was in the automobile business, I think, or had been. And he became a dollar-a-year deputy sheriff, and they were big on bootleggers, Barron County being a dry county. And so I worked with him a lot in trying to catch bootleggers and whiskey runners and so forth, and which we did catch an awful lot of. And then, of course, Louis didn't run for re-election. I don't know what he did from the time he went out of, other than the term practicing law. And Lee then, and Thruston Morton, Lee, Louis' brother, went to work for Thruston as administrative assistant. And Louis practiced law for a number of years and was always involved in politics and campaign manager for Thruston or something, but he was always involved. And then, of course, he ran for governor, what, twice. The first time he got defeated, I guess, by Governor Breathitt. And then the second time he ran against Ward and was elected governor and served his 4 years as governor. And stayed in Lexington, I think, and practiced, but now he's back in Glasgow. Well, Park, Kentucky is really where he lives, which is out near Griderville. And but he practices law out of Glasgow.
Also, why did you go to Owensboro for fingerprinting when the marshal's office was in Louisville when
they
you first joined?
They were having court there in the marshal, and back at that time when you had court, the whole shebang just packed up and moved to the city and where court was going. That's your clerks, your FBI, Secret Service, the marshals, the judge, and everyone went down to the division. So it was a regular term of court. You normally had court in those divisions twice a year, the spring and the fall. And you had grand jurors sitting in each of the divisions, and they would return their indictments in that particular division. And I guess I'd have to go back and say a division is made up of so many counties, like the Bowling Green Division would be made up of 18 counties in the south central part. Owensboro would be made up, and I can't recall off the top of my head, but maybe nine or 12 counties, from Litchfield, which is Grayson County, Davies County. Oh, when you had your term of court came up, then the courts just packed up and moved to that city and handled their civil and criminal docket. And the court was being handled in Owensboro, and the marshal was there, and so it was just as close for me from Glasgow to go to Owensboro as it was Lowell. And so I went down and that morning was fingerprinted and so forth.
And my last cleanup question, which may not be a fair question, but is there somebody that you could point to that had perhaps the greatest influence on you before you became a marshal, during your growing up days?
My mother, probably.
How was that?
Well, she was just a very hard-working very religious person, never missed church or Sunday school. She was Baptist, and she made all the grandchildren on Sundays. She would get all the grandchildren together and make them go to Sunday school, including me.
The grandchildren?
Grandchildren and me, being the baby of six. And my older brothers and sisters and had children, and so she would make them go to church. And I don't know, she was just a fine lady. She died very young with a brain tumor at age 54. But I think she probably, and most people say that I have a personality a lot like hers. I hope so. If I do, I think it'd be great. I don't know. And coming from the background that I did, which was a very poor family, that I was just sort of determined that even though I didn't go on at that time and get an education or higher education, I was determined I was going to make something of myself and do the best I could with what I had to do with. Law enforcement just sort of, after I got into it, it just sort of seemed to be my thing, and I enjoyed it. And not, of course, back then you didn't have Miranda, all these rights and so forth, and what a police officer said was it, you know, and particularly when if the federal spoke, well, that was, that's the way it was. Not that I was in it for any power or I wasn't a type of person, but I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed the work and felt like I was contributing something. And maybe I got that after my mother. She was a nurse and she enjoyed it. My sister then is still a practical nurse in Caverna. She lives in Glasgow, but she commutes to Caverna. Her daughter is an RN at Vanderbilt in Nashville, so the nursing sort of runs in the family. But I'm the only one that got involved in law enforcement. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
When we finished the last time, we were talking about Little Rock, and you had just talked about the fact that you were one of the four marshals that they chose to retain there after they dismissed or discharged, or whatever you would call it, the larger group of marshals. Do you remember anything about that final period?
No,
how
not
long
really.
It lasted?
They, it, but I, about a month, I think, and we didn't do an awful lot. As I say, we served a lot of TROs, temporary restraining orders, and this sort of thing, but we didn't do an awful lot. And it was two from Kentucky, two marshals, myself and Gilbert Bryant, and two deputies from Mississippi. Then we were the four that stayed for that extra month or so. And what had happened after you realized there wasn't going to be anything much going on, that the schools were not going to open and this sort of thing, then they, all the marshals that were in there, and I do not recall how many. And of course, at that time, I was just one of the deputies. I had not, we'd had no training or this sort of thing. And I had no supervisory responsibility or this sort of thing. So anyway, after they realized there wasn't anything going to happen or go on, then the majority of the marshals went back to their home districts and the four of us stayed in about a month, and then we came back home. After getting back, I guess they realized that if we were going to be involved in this, that we had better receive some training. And
now this, you're talking about the higher up people in the Marshal
right,
Service realized this?
The Justice Department. And being part of the responsibility of the marshals to carry out federal court orders. And it looked like that this was going to open up, and then we're going to see an awful lot of cases, in particularly in the South, going into federal court in order and desegregation.
Civil rights.
And so I guess the powers to be felt like that, you know, if it was the marshal's responsibility to carry out federal court orders, that we had better start getting some training and so forth. So in 1959, about January, I think, they started a school in the National Federal Youth Center in Washington, D.C. And this was an institution for handling juveniles, mostly. But the Marshal Service established a school there. And so I attended, in, not in January, but sometime that early spring, in February, maybe March. Then I was to go attend at school, which I did.
Did that become required for everybody, or was it just...
Every marshal, yeah. Well, I think there was maybe an age to it, because at that time you did have a lot of older marshals or deputy marshals. Now, when you're speaking of marshals, you're speaking mostly of deputy marshals. The marshals themselves are more of an administrator and presidential appointee for a term. Chief deputy marshals and deputy marshals are career people. And so all the deputy marshals of certain age category went through this training. So my 2 weeks training there, evidently someone must like what they saw of me or whatever, but from that then I was selected to become an instructor. And I came back after finishing, completing that training, I came back to Western Kentucky, back to Louisville. And in the late summer of 1959, decided this should be a training program, an upgraded refresher in El Reno, Oklahoma. So I was sent along with about six other instructors to set up the school in El Reno, Oklahoma, which there is a federal institution there, and we were using their facilities. We set up a training school, and we were returning. We were running 40 or 50 deputy marshals through the school for a 2-week period. Well, we realized after we got to set this up that it had a dual purpose. And one of them was that we would be much closer to Little Rock and we'd all be together, and with one move we could move in several marshals into Little Rock if necessary for that fall. But we were not told this. We were there for training purposes only, and that was it. But reading between the lines, I think that's why we were sent in there for training and to be available if they needed marshals in Little Rock for that fall school term. And which they didn't, and we didn't go. But we had overlap classes, like we would have 40 to 50 deputy marshals maybe in a class, and we would have the other trainees come in 2 days early, so we would always have 80 to 100 marshals there within a 2 or 3 day period, which would be the first group that would be sent in to Little Rock should we have to go. And we didn't. And as I say, I did not see this in writing, or did any. We just figured that this must be what we were there for. We were not told that. But we were available.
Could you take a minute to describe the training? What kind of training was it?
Well, we had quite a bit, but mostly my part of it was mostly mob and crowd control.
Now, is that physical or psychological?
Both. I would handle mostly the physical part of it, and they would have other guest instructors and so forth. I did all the studying and reading that I could on this. And we found out it's almost, well, I guess we'll get into it a little bit later, but normally in mob or riot control, it takes a pretty level-headed individual. If not, well, then you can do more damage than you do good. And an awful lot of common sense. And normally in a mob, you'll have a few that are the instigators and get everybody riled up. So the idea is to finger those people and let them know they've been fingered. And a lot of times they sort of disappear into the woodwork because they realize that if anything's going on, they're going to be the first ones that's going to be gotten or taken.
Is that what you mean by finger? Do you mean to threaten them or?
No, just realize and pick out who the troublemakers really are. And you know, and if you've got a crowd of 1,000 people out there, you may have 30 or 40 that's agitating them. So what you try to do is isolate those agitators, you know, you can start watching them, and they realize that they are being fingered, so to speak, that they've been picked out, that, you know, they realize if anything goes down, that they're going to be the first ones that's going to get it, arrested or whatever. So anyway, this was mostly, my part of it was mostly the physical. And so I've been in the Army, and we did training through a lot of formations and how to split a crowd and how to move them back and, you know, the use of your nightsticks and your use of your gas and you have all these different formations for different purposes. You know, if you're going to just move people back, you use a particular formation. Then what you try to do is split them and get them into smaller groups so you have a particular formation that you use for that. And, so that was mainly my part of it. That we did an awful lot of military type training, such as marching and, you know, to operate as a group and almost like a ball team. You know, it takes everyone working together to be effective, and that's what we try to do. And we was very successful at it, I think.
What about any physical endurance
we
training?
We had an awful lot of physical. They taught a lot of things. Handling of prisoners, judo at that time was the big thing, and we had some people, and I taught some of it, but I did not hold a belt in it, but a couple of our instructors did. But of course then I was 25, 26 years old, and it was pretty physical, We taught how the proper way to handle prisoners and, you know, to cuff them and proper way to fingerprint. And we had an awful lot of other type training rather than just the mob or riot control. But that was the main thing at that time, was to get as many marshals trained under mob and riot control as we could, so we could have a force of a couple of hundred maybe to move in at any particular time. And it just kept getting better. I mean, we eventually ended up with a special operations group or SWAT team, so to speak, and this was a very physical, but that came a long time later.
I believe I saw in your scrapbook an award that you received for being an instructor?
I was very fortunate to receive quite a few awards. Yeah, I received one from Attorney General Bobby Kennedy.
At this time?
Shortly after that. Yeah.
Okay. But all for training as an instructor?
As an instructor.
So far.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And
why do you think you got them? Did all instructors get them?
Maybe not the same time, but most instructors, I think, did, because we were sort of the leaders, so to speak. If you had a problem and you called a group of marshals in, normally two or three of the instructors were always there as the sort of the supervisor or running it. You know, there's always people there from Justice Department that was overall in charge. But if it got down to having to get involved physically or the actual groundwork, well, then we were there to see if that was carried out and carried out properly.
Now, why were you chosen to be an instructor? Do you know what?
Well, I don't know. I guess they must have liked my ability to do these things. And
now you had fooled around, as you called it, with the handcuffs before this time.
Yeah, I had.
So that was one thing you had.
Yeah, I had fool around with that. I guess they liked my, even though I was young, I was very mature, I think, for my age. I don't know. I must have impressed them with the way I did things. I they never told me, and I don't know why. I was honored to be selected and was proud to do it. But anyway, after El Reno, then, our training in school, opening time came and went, and we were not needed in Little Rock when, after our classes were over, then we came on back home.
Can I interrupt you one more time?
Sure.
I would rather let you talk, but I don't want to lose a couple of things. And I wanted to ask you specifically before we move on to the other towns that in which you found yourself, and that is, it's a long time ago, but can you describe something of the mood, both in the country as seen by the marshals and in the marshal service itself? In other words, here was Little Rock. Most of the desegregation incidents hadn't occurred yet. But do I infer from what you said that you had a clear sense that something bad was coming? There were going to be repetitions of Little Rock, or what?
Well, I didn't at the time, but I'm sure that the powers to be did, that it looked like that, you were beginning to get a lot of protests or demanding of rights and so forth by minority groups, and so I guess the powers to be felt like this could be something that we might be involved in, and that we'd better be prepared, or the federal government had. I don't know if anything happened between that time. I don't recall of anything of any significance handling. I came on back and did district work and continued into training. And we had no permanent school at that time, so what we would do is hold training at federal facilities, such as El Reno on the institution grounds there. We had school in Greenville, South Carolina, an Air Force base. There was also a prison camp there. We had school at the United States Penitentiary in Atlanta. We had school at the U.S. Penitentiary, Terre Haute, Indiana, which is a federal prison located there. We had school at Fort Knox, Kentucky. I don't know this, but I like to think that it was because of my situation at the time that, of course, I had gotten married. This was an early '60s, about '61 or whatever, and we were scheduled for some classes, and I was to be an instructor, but I had a wife and a newborn baby, and I was begging to not be sent.
You were married in 1960,
right.
But by this time it was 61.
Yeah, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of things that went on, but anyway, I like to think that then they scheduled, they said, well, I just didn't feel like I could be gone overnight or very far away from home. And so Jack Cameron, which was the associate director of the Marshal Service, was sort of overall in charge of training. And he said, well, let's see what they could do. And so I like to think that the reason I set it up in Fort Knox is because I could be there and it would be close to home and I could commute from home. But anyway, we went on in 1959. I don't recall anything happening in August.
Can I ask you about that?
Sure.
There's something about somebody named Slippery Bill Gully in your scrapbook. Did you have anything to do with
that? Well, that was a district. Yeah, that was a district matter. He was a an escape artist, and I don't recall what he was charged with in the federal system. But I was in Terre Haute, Indiana, working on a big criminal case, not on a case per se, but handling a jury in a big criminal case. And well, they had federal court here in Louisville, and they had several prisoners that they were taking down to the court. The Marshal Service has a holdover, which is just cell blocks and only there to handle prisoners while they're waiting to go before the court. Then you might take 7 or 8, 10 prisoners into court at one time, and they would be arraigned and an attorney's appointed to represent them if they did not have attorneys. And then you would bring them back to the cell block, and attorneys would have a chance to interview them, talk to them, and so forth. So anyway, although I was in Terre Haute, I heard this and got a phone call that night, and from the courtroom up to the Marshal Service, which is located on the same floor, at that time the second floor of the old post office building, now the Gene Snyder building. And there was marshal in front, one in the center, and one in the rear. And on the way from the courtroom back to the Marshal Service, this one prisoner ran. And they were not cuffed, which they should have been, but they weren't. Normally you would cuff them all together, so you'd have a line of 10 prisoners and they'd all cuff together, so no way one could run. These weren't, they were just walking back from the courtroom to the Marshal Service. So the chief deputy at that time was Everett Langford, and come to find out later, in the bullet hole was still in the wall there in the old building. So the chief deputy then took off after the Slippery Bill Gully, as the press named him. It was Bill Gully, and I think this was maybe his third or fourth escape or something. And going from the second floor to the first floor, he ran down those steps. Well, there's a little landing as you come off the second floor, the little landing, and then another set of steps to the first floor. And Langford shot at him as he was on that landing. Well, about the time Langford shot, Gully's feet flew out from under him, which is marble flooring. And Langford hit that wall. And the hole is chip is still there out of that marble where he shot him. So they went out the 6th Street entrance, and Langford shot at him again and shot the glass out of the doors on 6th Street. Again, missing Slippery Bill. So he ran him to 4th Street and lost him. And so, of course, the FBI and everybody was out looking for him, and I don't know, I came on back from Terre Haute from finishing my duty there.
So you weren't there at the time?
I wasn't there at the time. And the state police had stopped a car down western Kentucky someplace, and it was Bill Gully. So the trooper, I don't know that knew who he had at the time, but he had him in the back of the police car. And are in the police car, and I presume was radioing in to see if this person was wanted or whatever, and Gully took off again and got away from the troop. And this was 2 or 3 days, and they finally found him down western Kentucky someplace. And he was lodged in a local jail, and so then we go down and get him and bring him back to Louisville to face the charge, with his original charge, plus he'd been indicted for escape and so forth.
Was there anything about the jury that you were handling in Terre Haute that's worth, I mean?
No, well, not okay. really. I had the one instance that got everyone all shook up, and I may have mentioned earlier that we were on, I believe it was the old Lafayette Terre Haute House, I believe, that we were housed. And we were on, I've forgotten what floor, but the U.S. Attorney had a floor below, and I think we talked about
that. Oh, this was that same one. Okay.
So anyway, then after the gully, I think you saw the picture in the scrapbook of myself and the marshal bringing him out after he was sentenced and getting him to court, and we finally got him onto the penitentiary, and I never heard any more out of him. I don't know whatever happened to him. So then, let's see, to get back to 1960, then I got married, and Barb and I were married in August of 1960. I don't recall anything exciting happening between, well, I may have. I think, not really exciting, but my first trip was to Alcatraz, was from fall of 59 till sometime between then and August of, no, it would have to have been January. I had just gotten back from Alcatraz and attended a party where I had met my present wife, Barbara.
January of 1960.
Yeah. And we had gone to Alcatraz to bring a person back.
Anything?
And we drove him by automobile. And this was a person that was a huge, very dangerous individual. He was from California originally, Harold Wayne Davis. Don't see any reason why I can't use his name, but he had been caught in Kentucky. He had kidnapped some people over him, going to rob a service station, I think, and took the young fellow and some woman as hostage. The troopers pulled up, and he was holding them as hostage. And the trooper talked him and his brother-in-law, which was Burton, I believe, into taking him and letting this young couple go. Which they did, and they Now, this all happened before I became a marshal. One of my first trips to Alcatraz was after I became a marshal to pick him up and bring him back. But anyway, the reason then he and his brother-in-law came into Kentucky, in Paducah, Kentucky, in a Missouri State Trooper's car. And of course they had everybody in that area, including Kentucky and Illinois and Indiana, was on the lookout for these people. But the problem when they came into Kentucky was that they were in a Missouri State Trooper's car, and here come all the Missouri State Troopers into Kentucky. And nobody knew which one was the troopers and which one was the criminals. They went out someplace down in the western part and kidnapped a farm camp family. And I don't know, you could go back and look at this, but they had roadblocks set up, and I don't know why this, I think was an insurance agent, was standing at the roadblock with these police officers and troopers and so forth. And some young couple, as I recall, came down the highway and saw this roadblock. But rather than get involved in it, they stopped and backed up and turned around to go back, and this civilian had nothing to do with law enforcement, and why is there, I don't know. And whether it was his gun, his rifle, or whatever he had, or if he picked one of them up and shot at this car, and I think killed the civilian, which had nothing to do, maybe the guy had a few beers or something. I don't know what his reason was, but they saw the roadblock. And this, and I'm going back by the paper at this because I was a policeman in Glasgow and we had a lookout for him, but we were so far removed it wouldn't have been likely. Anyway, then Harold Wayne, his brother-in-law, went out to some community there and kidnapped a farm couple. And the police finally had them located, I think, and was moving in on them. And Burton, the brother, one brother-in-law, ran. And he hid in a coal bin someplace there within a few hundred yards or a mile or something. But anyway, they caught him in this coal bin. And Harold Wayne, the guy that we later went to Alcatraz to bring back, went in the back. As the police were moving in, he realized that he didn't have much of a chance. He walked out back and shot himself. So after this, of course, they got the ambulance in, got him in, and was treated there in Paducah in an emergency situation, but he was able to travel and been a federal offense on the kidnapping and so forth. Why the Bureau of Prisons, rather than put guards on him in a civilian hospital there in the Paducah area, they by ambulance moved him to the U.S. Penitentiary Terre Haute, where he was treated for his gunshot wound. He survived, of course, and came back into to Kentucky. The marshals brought him back into Kentucky, and he went before Judge Brooks, and Henry Brooks was U.S. District Judge at the time. And Judge Brooks gave him, I think he pled guilty to this, and Brooks gave him a life sentence. Well, at that time, a federal life sentence, you had to serve 15 years before you were eligible for parole. And the Bureau of Prisons ordered and committed directly to Alcatraz, which is very seldom ever done.
Why was that?
He was wanted in California for murder. He'd killed a policeman there, I think, a motorcycle policeman. And where in California, I don't know, but he had robbed a place, I think, and this motorcycle policeman had no idea. And as he came around the corner, Davis evidently thought he was after him for robbing the place, and the motorcycle officer didn't even know what was going on, and so Davis shot him.
So Alcatraz is for the worst
offenders. You just did not commit normally directly. Marshals did not commit directly to Alcatraz. Normally those people in Alcatraz were moved from some of your other maximum security prisons. But anyway, then after I became a marshal then in 58, but then in the early, I guess, 60, he had filed for a writ that he was brought back here and sentenced, and he pled guilty and really was not in the proper frame of mind, or had just gotten out of the hospital and blah, 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 a lot of reasons why he was attacking the sentence on a 2255. So he was ordered to return here, and so we drove out and got him. And at that time, I don't know who the warden was, but said that he had rather see anybody on the rock taken off of there other than Harold Lane, because he was really a bad customer. So anyway, the two of us drove out, and then the marshal himself flew out and rode back with us.
So now who was the other deputy?
Gilbert Bryant. Mm-hmm. And we were in Gilbert's car. So when you're moving across country with federal prisoners, you have a book of federal approved jails, and only those jails could you put a federal prisoner in. And these were jails that had been inspected and approved by the Bureau of Prisons. So you're coming out, when you're moving and going out west, as you know, if you've driven by automobile out that way, that you might have to drive 600-700 miles from one city to another, and particularly when you were limited to the type of jail that you could put these people in. He gave us no trouble. We leg ironed him and waist chained him and this sort of thing, which stayed on him until from morning till night. We put them on the inside of the jail, and we didn't take them off until we got inside of the next jail that night. And we were on the road maybe 5-6 days from San Francisco. And you could have probably made it sooner, but you have to realize that you have to stop, and these people have to use restrooms, or you have to feed them and this sort of thing. But they do this with the waist chains and leg irons and cuffs on. You don't take those off for any reason, particularly a guy like this. We brought him back, and I think his writ was, of course, denied, and I don't remember what attorney represented him at the time. Oh, I tell you, it was Frank Haddad, because I laugh about it today. When this guy, when we got him off, and I didn't know Frank, when we got him off of the island, which you, of course, go by boat, and when we got off the boat and put him in the car, and this was done by Bureau of Prison people and Gilbert and myself and the marshal. And once we got on that mainland, well, he was all ours. The Bureau of Prison had no authority or jurisdiction. And the first thing he said was that he wanted to know if he could pick his own attorney. And I don't care, but I one says, well, not usually. The courts appoint an attorney from a list, which at that time attorneys were not paid. He says, well, I don't want any attorney. I want Frank Haddad. Well, here's a guy that had, as far as I knew, had not been no connections or been in Louisville or anything else. And I thought, who the hell is this Frank Haddad? You know, here's the guy from California getting him out of Alcatraz. And of course, Haddad at that time was fairly young, starting practicing, but he must have had a reputation off early. So anyway, when he got back, I think Brooks did, you know, rather than ask Frank, and Frank agreed to do it. Of course, there was no money or no fee. But I was thinking on the way back, I got to know who this Haddad is. He must be something else. But Judge Brooks called Frank, and Frank did agree to represent him, although he was not on the list of appointed attorneys or didn't do that, but as a friend of the court, he did represent Harold Wayne. He was denied, of course, but we sent him, we did not take him back to Alcatraz. We took him to Leavenworth, Kansas, which is a maximum security prison. And I don't know whatever, I never heard any more about him. I don't know whether he finished that life sentence or whether he even lived through it or whether he's back in California on a murder charge. And I was going through his file the first night in the motel room. I was looking through his file. And he has some pretty vicious... he's sort of a wild type person. He had been sentenced to so many months, and I don't know whether this is proper to say this or not, but for one of them was for biting his wife's breast off. he was just a wild individual. But I never heard any more from him, so I don't know what happened to him. But anyway, and then that must have been January. So at a party in January, I had met my present wife, Barbara.
And her name at that time was?
Mann, M-A-N-N. She was from, she was teaching school here in Louisville, but she was originally from Cumberland County. And her father was in the state senate. He may have been in the House at that time, was later elected to the Senate from Cumberland County, Monroe, Cumberland, Russell, down that area. And it was, my wife was there with a date, and she had a friend that they roomed together that was also a teacher. And they were, I guess, looking for a date for the friend. And Barbara tells us better than I, but that she, Patsy said, well, there, and I knew Barbara's date. He was from Glasgow originally, so I knew him. And Patsy said, well, there, this is Barbara's friend. There's a fellow that I might be interested in dating. And so Barbara's dad said, well, I know him, so. Well, I met the table and introduced me, and we chatted a while. But I ended up taking Barbara home, and her date ended up taking the girl that they were trying to fix me up with. But anyway, then we got married in August in 1960, and we had, it wasn't really much of a honeymoon, but I had taken a week off, and we'd gotten married in Southern Illinois, and I made the mistake, I guess, of calling my office. We were sort of working our way back to Louisville anyway, but they had called and wanted me back immediately that was calling Mr. Beasy to be in New Orleans on so-and-so day. So I came on back. Two or three days early, and immediately then took off to New Orleans. That Judge J. Skelly Wright was U.S. District Judge at that time in New Orleans, and had ordered the city of New Orleans to integrate their public schools. And I don't recall how many marshals were in there because we were scattered out. We were having to stay, of course, in motels, hotels, and whatever. But there was, I'm guessing, but I would say probably 60 or 80 marshals maybe called in there.
In the motel?
The,
in New Orleans?
In to New Orleans. And then I, and along with, although we went to separate schools, there was about eight of us, I think, that were selected to take these two children into two separate schools.
When you got there, had there been any violence or any demonstrations or?
No, I mean, not
nothing.
That I know of.
You were just there as precautionary
there,
at that point.
And, well, that the judge wanted us to take those children to school, and just in case. But in the meantime, there was an awful lot of, I think Jimmy Davis was the governor of Louisiana at the time. And didn't he write "You Are My Sunshine," or he was some sort of songwriter back before he became governor. But the state legislation was in session, and he was fighting the desegregation order of Judge Wright. And they were passing bills left and right in Baton Rouge, which is about 80 miles from New Orleans. And we were having, Judge Wright was signing orders declaring the state legislature's bills unconstitutional. So we had about four marshals that were keeping the road, should get that message.
Okay.
Keeping the road hot, running between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and these were local marshals, Louisiana marshals.
The local marshals were running back and forth.
To serve these orders on the governor and the powers to be in Baton Rouge, which is the capital of Louisiana. And they'd get back and they'd pass another one, and Judge Wright would strike this. So this went on several days. And it came the day for the schools to open, and on a Sunday before they were to open, there was eight of us, I think, with a local driver chosen to forward to each school with a child and a local driver, and that we were to take these two children in their respective schools. On Sunday afternoon, we went and met Judge Wright in his office in the federal courthouse there in New Orleans. And, of course, the governor and state powers were threatening to arrest anyone that had anything to do with bringing these children into their schools. And this was all in the newspaper and on TV and so forth. And Judge Wright says that he wanted us to be sure that everyone there knew who we were and that we had a copy of this order, his order ordering these children to attend those schools. And to make sure that we had proper ID where everyone could see it, and that if we were arrested, then he assured us that he would get us out of jail. And I was thinking to myself, you can't get us out of jail because you don't know where we are. I ain't going to writ. You got to be directed to the keeper or the jailer, the keeper of the institution, and they would move you around so fast they couldn't get them. They never would find you in those parishes down there.
You knew this. I mean,
well, but I was thinking this. Yeah. But it was part of the job, and I thought, they're not going to arrest me. I'm not going in jail. And of course, I guess the worst thing could have happened if it had gotten where I had to hurt someone rather than to go, I would have been a pretty bad situation, I'm sure. But anyway, the city of New Orleans, which police department, which was better than a lot of other places that we had to go later, the chief came on TV and says that, this was on the weekend, that the city police in the city of New Orleans had nothing to do with carrying out any federal court order, and they were not carrying out any federal court order, but it was their responsibility to keep peace and quiet in their city, and that they were going to do that regardless of what was going on. They wanted the citizens to know that it was not, that they were not carrying out any federal court order. And he was a very strong, tough chief. I had read some about him prior to going down there, but and then after reading in the newspaper and watching him on TV, he was pretty, he was a cop. I mean, he was a good policeman. And of course, in New Orleans, they'd use horses for mob control and at Mardi Gras and this sort of thing. So 100,000 people didn't mean much to them as far as trying to handle crowds. And on Monday morning, a local marshal drove myself and three others, to the, well, we were in two cars, as I recall. I was in the car with the young lady. I went to the, drove us out to the house, and the young girl was dressed and ready for school. And we got in the front car.
Did you know her name at the time?
No. Well, I knew it, but I had forgotten it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was told. Mm-hmm. Was there. And I talked to her a little bit before we left while her parents, her mother was particularly standing there. You know, she was, I don't think she really realized what was going on so much, but I assured her that we...
She didn't seem nervous, or...?
No, she seemed to be very calm. I don't think she realized, the full impact of what was going on. So anyway, when we get to our school...
Can I just interrupt you a minute? How about the mother? What was she, how did she seem?
Very calm. She believed in what was going on, and she thought it was the way she talked, that it was the best for her child, and the only thing she wanted is the best education she could get for her. And very nice lady. So we pull up from our school, and I mean there was a mob, thousands of people.
Were you prepared for that?
Well, I was prepared for some problems, but not that many, I don't think. And I thought, well, my job is to protect this young lady, and I will do that to the best of my ability. And so when you see the picture of Norman Rockwell, that is not the way that we went in school. You always keep yourself between the individual you're trying to protect and those that are trying to harm them, and so you wouldn't have no marshal with any proper training would have left that girl in between four marshals and open to the crowd, you know. So you kept the child to your body between she and the mob. You could make sure that she wasn't going to get hit with anything, but you could not keep her from hearing some of the things that she was being called and what we were being called and so forth. But the police were there.
Not repeatable, I assume?
Not repeatable. It was just everything you can imagine. The police were there. They were on their horses, and we'd go into school. The principal, the vice principal, and several other people were standing inside the door and greeted us. I had an armband on, stated United States Marshal. I had a badge on my coat lapel, the United States Marshal's badge, so there'd be no doubt as to who I was. And
how were you greeted?
Nice. I mean, the principal introduced himself and introduced us to myself and the other two or three marshals over there to the other people. And noticed one fella standing back to the side in a suit. And I went over to him to ask him who he was. And he said he was a state trooper. And sort of raised his arms and says, "I'm not armed." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Observing." And I said, "Well, if you observe, you have to observe from outside, and you can't stay in the school." And he walked out. And I thought to myself, when he said I wasn't armed, I thought, "Well, this guy's a patsy. I don't have to worry about him." He must have been afraid I was going to shoot him or something. So anyway, then the teacher and I and the young lady walked into the classroom. There was no other students in the school that I could see. We go in the classroom and the teacher starts teaching just as if it was a full class of students there. And I could hear all this noise from the street, but from the classroom I couldn't see it. And I sit in the back of the classroom, and I would go out the back door into the corridor and look out the window. I was facing the mob, which was this window was on the front part of the school. And I would stare in there a few minutes and watch the police, in which they handled great. A lot of these people, after they started busting them up and getting them, moving them out, there was a little drugstore or grocery store, as I recall, on the corner. And one policeman went in there and ordered everybody out, and another policeman on a horse was standing on his horse, standing in front of this little drugstore or grocery. And as these people would come out, that horse would take his head and knock one way, and the next one come out, he'd knock them other. So that horse was separating them and keeping them from getting back together and forming another mob. And to watch those horses work in a crowd control was beautiful. I mean, they were just... that policeman could get that horse moving sideways, and you take a 2,000-pound horse and him sidestepping on you and using his whole body to push you, he can move a lot of people. And plus, you're certainly scared he's going to step on your foot or something, but you know what damage you can do. So when those horses wanted to move you, they'd move you. And then at lunchtime, then they were still, little groups would form and get back, and the policemen were all day, you know, keeping these groups from getting too big and keeping them small where you could handle them a lot easier. And at lunchtime, then I think the young girl had her lunch. I'm really not sure. But we went down to the lunchroom. And in the lunchroom, here was all these policemen. Well, I knew there were some in the school in their riot gear. But they were out completely out of sight of civilians or citizens, and they were there as a backup and an emergency in case they needed more policemen out front. They had nothing to say to me. I would speak, they wouldn't even speak. They were, I'm sure, resented what was going on, and the majority of them did. But we sat, and the little girl had her lunch, and we used our 30-minute lunch period, and I, of course, was well set with her. And I took her back up to classroom. And then after that afternoon, when class was out, we walked out the front door, and we didn't sneak in or out. I did have had gone in there and knew the emergency exits and how to get out of there other ways than the front door should it become necessary.